Welcome back to the Falklands War Podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 7. The Argentinians invaded the Falklands on the 2nd of April 1982, and as you heard last episode, the main force took the islands after a short firefight at Government House, which left one Argentinian dead and two wounded and one Royal Marine wounded in the arm there. The Army's 25th Regiment was already flying in from the mainland airfield of Comodoro Rivadavia to replace the Marine Landing Force. It would be followed by the 9th Engineer Company, and these two units would constitute the first Argentine garrison in the Falklands. Four of the important planes in the coming conflict, the Bucaras, of the 3rd Attack Group, then carried out a flypast and landed at Port Stanley Airfield. The Argentinian 25th Regiment was going to be the main force and the garrison, and they were chosen because they were the closest unit to the islands. Some have suggested they were chosen symbolically as superior troops selected from various units, but Argentinians say this is false. They were a normal unit with professional soldiers and NCOs, but all the privates were conscripts. This was going to have a bearing on what happened when the fighting started later. The British were sending professionals, whereas the Argentinian backbone of soldiers were all conscripts, and in the coming hand-to-hand battles and trenches, this would be a telling difference. The British officials on the Falklands were removed on the same day, including most of the Royal Marines, who were quickly rounded up. Their commanding officer, Major Norman, later said that his men were treated well by their captors, except when the Argentinian 2nd Marine Infantry Battalion arrived. They weren't involved in any fighting and yet had set out to humiliate the British troops. The Royal Marines were then sent in small groups to their Moody Brook barracks, but discovered that their personal belongings had been stolen. Money, cameras, radio cassettes. The Argentinians listened politely to the complaints, then loaded the Marines into a C-130 Hercules at the airport on the evening of the 2nd of April, and they were flown to Comodoro Rivadavia on the mainland. Governor Hunt, his family and other administration officials left at the same time in a Fokker F-28, but were flown to Buenos Aires, then Montevideo, and finally England. Back in the Falklands, six Marines were missing. They had been close to the entrance of Stanley Harbour and withdrew into open country, hoping to avoid capture and maintain a military presence there for as long as possible. The only problem was, they had just arrived on the islands and had no experience. These islands are notoriously difficult to survive for islanders alone, and greenhorn would-be kelpers had no chance. The responsibility of the Falklands passed from the Argentine Navy to the Army before the day was over, although reports that a British sub was lurking offshore caused some trepidation. The Buzos Tacticos Beach Specialist Force and the amphibious commandos were flown home, and most were back in their own quarters on the mainland at Mar del Plata, 1,000 miles north, by nightfall. The command was handed over to Brigadier General Americo Dahe, whose 9 brigade troops were now massing on the island. Dahe had 650 men available for that first night, and he was rather worried about the garrison numbers, particularly as the islands are roughly the size of Wales, and he had no idea what the kelpers were going to do. Buenos Aires had a second plan to seize South Georgia on the same day, but could not go ahead with that action because of the storm at sea you heard about. We'll return to what happened there in a minute. While this was going on, Argentina erupted in a day of ecstasy. A communique announced that the 52-year-old commander of the Buenos Aires First Army Corps, General Mario Benjamin Menendez, had been appointed governor of the Islas Malvinas. At a rally later outside the Casa Rosada presidential palace, General Galtieri told a jubilant crowd that the three commanders-in-chief of the junta had intercepted the will of the people. His voice constantly broke with emotion at the spectacle before him. Not since the days of Perón had a soldier been so well received. A few days before, his police had shot civilians in the same plaza. Now the square was filled with thousands weeping tears of joy. In London, the 2nd of April, Friday, was a brilliant spring day, but Westminster and Whitehall were in shock, chilled to the bone by the news. Everyone was talking in hushed tones. It was only hours before that Margaret Thatcher's cabinet had been discussing methods of deterrence, and now these ideas were moot. What was even more incredible is that throughout Friday, long after the Argentinians had seized Port Stanley, the British establishment was incredulous about a full invasion. Their communications had been difficult with the Falklands for a number of reasons, including the bad weather, and they were monitoring the Buenos Aires celebrations with a sense of disbelief. For more than 8 hours after the invasion, Thatcher's government had no way of knowing whether the reports from Argentina were true. Humphrey Atkins, as part of the senior foreign office in the Commons, then made a disastrously misleading statement from the dispatch box. He said that his department had been in contact with Governor Hunt 2 hours earlier and no invasion had been reported. In fact, the contact with Hunt was 4 hours earlier, just before the Argentinian invasion. Most who heard Atkins thought he was lying because independent reporters in Buenos Aires had no doubt that the invasion had taken place earlier that morning. They were filing their reports back to Great Britain. At 2:30 p.m., things got worse for the English when radio stations, including the BBC, reported that there was dancing in the streets of Buenos Aires, and yet the leader of the British House of Parliament, Francis Pym, rose to give another holding statement. He promised an emergency session of Parliament for Saturday the next day if the situation in the Falklands deteriorated. Margaret Thatcher's cabinet was still in the dark and had completely lost touch of events. It was only after 5 p.m., 12 hours after the invasion had started, that Lord Carrington and John Knott held a press conference confirming the invasion, and both appeared shocked. However, three things were in Margaret Thatcher's favour in terms of a response. Firstly, on the Monday before the invasion, the nuclear submarines had been dispatched to the southern Atlantic. Then on Wednesday, the fleet had been placed on alert, and on Thursday, they'd been given the go-ahead to sail for the Falklands and South Georgia, so mentally they were ready. From being on the back foot, the British were going to land up dictating affairs and having the initiative pretty much from now on. Thatcher needed every member of her cabinet to support the war, though. At a meeting that evening, they all gave their support. Then they began planning the task force. The next day, Saturday, 3rd of April, the House rose as one to support the idea of a war force to be sent to retake the Falklands. But by Monday, Carrington had resigned, along with Humphrey Atkins. They'd been the focus of too much bad news and poor intelligence. The job of Foreign Secretary went to House of Commons leader Francis Pym, who Thatcher despised. She had fired him from the Ministry of Defence, indicating he was spineless in his inability to control defence spending, and he was seemingly unable to cope with civil servants, she indicated. And here he was, Foreign Secretary. He was what she called a wet, and often holding what was called an indefinite point of view, a politician's politician, doing nothing for as long as possible while protecting his own skin. Thatcher then informed Whitehall in brutal clarity about what she expected, to see the islands returned to the British administration. She then set up a small steering committee to run the coming war, bypassing the normal technocrat machinery. It was comprised of the Prime Minister, her deputy, the Home Secretary William Whitelaw, Foreign Secretary Francis Pym, and Defence Secretary John Knott. There were others drafted in, such as Chief of Defence Staff Sir Terence Lewin. One of the more important inner circle as head of the communications group was Michael Pallister. His task was to keep other departments and ministers briefed and to prepare papers for the War Cabinet on legal matters. Thus disposed, Britain went to war for the first time since the disastrous Suez Crisis, and each time experienced ministers thought of Anthony Eden, they shuddered in fear. For the fleet, this was a time of sudden change, but not unexpected. The first flotilla of destroyers and frigates were clearly to be the spearhead of the task force. It was already at sea under the command of 50-year-old Rear Admiral Sandy Woodward. He was going to find himself having to take orders, though, from a three-ring Admiral Shortley. The Royal Navy was run by a sequence of fraternal societies. First, the destroyer captains, then Fleet Air Arm Officers. Although, what had happened in 1982, it was the submariners who dominated fleet command, and Woodward was a submariner. But successfully taking control of a force which would be sent more than 8,000 miles away would require a bit of luck along with experience. There was the pressing need for air cover. Britain only had two aircraft carriers, the Invincible and the Hermes. Invincible was small, and Hermes was old, and neither could carry many aircraft. If both were packed to capacity with the Fleet Air Arm's only relevant plane, the Harrier, then they'd only have the very minimum air support for the southern Atlantic. Because the British had allowed their defence systems to age badly over the preceding 10 years, they had weakened their systems when they needed them most. The immediate strategic need was defence against air attack. And as you get to hear, the Argentinian Air Force was not to be taken lightly. At sea at that point were three modern air defence ships, the Type 42 destroyers Coventry, Glasgow and Sheffield. They were armed with a Sea Dart missile defence system, and for close air defence, the only ships with modern missiles were three Type 22 frigates equipped with Seawolf missiles. They were really anti-submarine vessels. One, Battle Axe, had technical problems and couldn't steam south. The other two, Broadsword and Brilliant, were going to join the task force. The rest of the frigates and destroyers were older, but would also be dispatched south. Most of these were out of their league in a conventional war against an opponent which had been updating its arms systems regularly with ship-killing missiles, something that the Russians have discovered recently in the Black Sea as their flagship Moskva was sunk by land-based Neptune missile systems. So the real issue was the Royal Navy in 1982 was an anti-submarine force designed to fight the Soviets in a NATO-style ground war. Now they were going to face an enemy with a very good air force, which would focus its missiles on the British Navy. Most of the advanced British vessels had been taking part in something called Exercise Spring Train. Some of these had been steaming around for 4 months, like the Sheffield. So they were ordered south. First, sailors were given some time to phone their wives, explaining they were now heading 8,000 miles in the other direction and would be away from the family for at least another 2 months. Those on board believed they'd turn back to Britain shortly. It was going to be saber-rattling and then some kind of political solution. Lieutenant David Tinker, who was secretary to the captain of the Glamorgan, wrote to his parents saying, "We are off to the Falkland Islands to bash the Argentinians. Of course, the whole thing may blow over in a week." His captain, Mike Barrow, was upbeat, hoping to finish his career in a blaze of glory. He was within a few months of retirement. The army, too, was stirring. Major General Jeremy Moore of the Royal Marines had been woken up on the 2nd of April by a telephone call informing him of the Falklands invasion. Like most others who received similar calls that morning, he initially reacted in total disbelief. He thought it was a belated April Fool's joke. Since the disbandment of the 16th Parachute Brigade in 1974, 3 Command Brigade was Britain's only thoroughly trained all-arms force that was ready for amphibious operations. Brigade commander was the highly respected and hugely talented Brigadier Julian Thompson. It was thought that the Navy would be running the show, so to speak, that they'd want their Marines to form the spearhead of a landing force. Strangely enough, that is what the Argentinians had thought too. And that's what the Argentinians did themselves. As I've said in this series already, there were many similarities and resonances when it came to the two sides, and here again was another. That same afternoon, on the 2nd, Lieutenant Colonel Nick Vaux, commanding officer of 42 Battalion, walked out to a staff car waiting for him, believing he was to be flown to America, only to discover he was being driven back to his own unit HQ. From there, he would begin the process of recalling everyone from leave. It reminded him, unfortunately, of the last time this happened, when he was a younger officer being called back from leave to deal with the Suez Crisis. Around the UK, military minds were clicking into gear. At the HQ of 22nd Special Air Service Regiment, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Rose ordered one squadron of the elite SAS to be on standby, knowing that they'd probably be heading off to the Falklands. Perhaps one of the most important and most eccentric of all officers who were mobilizing themselves or their men or both that day was Major Ewan Southby-Taylor. He had been staying in a small apartment in London while attending a cruising club dinner. He was famous for telling anyone who'd listen that in 22 years of being in the army, he'd only spent 2 of those in an office. This, of course, had ruined his chances of promotion, but did help him sail halfway around the world. A typical British eccentric, he could speak Arabic, was a master of watercolour painting of seabirds, had spent months exploring the deserts around Jordan and Saudi Arabia, and he had spent many more months sailing around the Falklands. In 1978, he'd been sent as part of a marine detachment to the windswept isolation of the Falklands and fell in love with them. He spent much of his time on a boat exploring the fjords, the bays and the inlets, taking notes and mapping the coast obsessively. His knowledge of every creek and beach was unsurpassed by anyone, and he was now to prove somewhat of an intelligence gem. He was going to help the 3 Commando Brigade carry out their amphibious landings on the Falklands. But when Major Southby Taylor arrived at Brigade HQ and met with its commander, Julian Thompson, he was loath to say anything.
"I'm not going to tell you a thing," said the eccentric Southby Taylor, "until you promise to take me with you."
Fortunately, Thompson had already decided he would and said, "Don't worry, Ewan, you're coming." The strange major had just caught the historical wind, the gust that blew him into his moment of military history. A huge planning operation was underway, as you can imagine. The broad concept for the landing of an amphibious force was laid out in that first weekend. As the brigade staff officers gathered, they were mindful of what had happened during the Suez Crisis, when political fiasco was compounded by such appalling confusion in the loading of shipping that the British could have been in grave difficulty had they met a more resolute enemy, and the Argentinians were going to be far more resolute than the British expected. Early on, Julian Thompson discovered that he could not use the Hermes because she was required for the Sea Harriers. He was hoping to use it as a platform for support helicopters. But even if he had both the Hermes and the Invincible, as well as every available aircraft, he'd only have 20 Harriers in total to provide air cover, a pitifully small force when battle casualties and technical faults began to take their toll. Hermes could carry only one company of 40 Commando as a contingency force. At that moment, a miracle of sorts was announced. The 45,000-ton cruise liner Canberra was to be requisitioned. She could carry 2,000 men in relative luxury. The British then set in motion the greatest mobilization of civilian shipping in support of the Royal Navy since the Second World War. Commander Brian Goodson had held his post as Field Logistics Coordinator for a grand total of 2 weeks when he was hit with a request list that was pages long. Storeships, dispatch vessels, tankers, hospital ships, repair vessels, container ships. 54 in all from civilian sources alone before the operation was complete. That was 500,000 tons of shipping. Then helicopter pads had to be fitted, captains briefed in the art of war, naval survival suits provided, pay scales to be fixed by the National Union of Servicemen. Within 6 days of the Argentinian invasion, the Canberra had been fitted with landing pads, new comms equipment, and reprovisioning at sea equipment, for example. Things were swift. Back in the South Atlantic, the Argentinians were busy. 800 miles southeast of the Falklands, at South George's Leith Harbour, the French yachtsmen we've heard about were woken by one of the scrapmen who called himself Tito. He was excited and told them that the Malvinas were taken and a force was on its way to take South Georgia as well. There was to be a flag-raising ceremony, and Captain Astiz had given permission for the French filmmakers to record the historical moment. Up to now, they had been forced to keep their cameras locked away. 2 flags were duly raised at Leith as a 54-mile-an-hour wind tugged at the blue and white material. Astiz's marines stood at attention, along with the scrapmen who then sang the national anthem. While Serge Brier filmed, they applauded and shouted, "Viva la Patria!" Then all the men signed the text of Astiz's declaration, which read in part, "On the 2nd April 1982, South Georgia became Isla San Pedro and is now under Argentine authority." All of this, of course, was slightly premature because Lieutenant Keith Mills and his handful of British Marines, along with the British Antarctic Survey scientists, were still in control of Grytviken up the South Georgia coast. Foul weather had slowed Astiz's plans, but it wouldn't be long before they had faced the Argentinians. Later that night, a subdued Astiz and his men sailed off from Leith to Grytviken aboard the Bahia Paraiso, boasting before they left of a quick victory. It was not going to be easy. The resistance of the 23 British Marines was extraordinary. Afterwards, an Argentinian officer told Mills that he had taken on 2 ships, 500 Argentinian Marines, and 3 helicopters. "There are no kamikazes left in Japan," said the officer. "They're all here." Mills was only 22, and he was to be awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for gallantry, and one of his men, Sergeant Major Peter Leach, was also decorated. But the real story before the action is one of confusion.
London's actions before they were attacked were so confused that they verged on banana republic laughable. In the hours before the battle, the vessel Endurance, which had abandoned its voyage to Stanley, received three different sets of orders. First, shoot only in self-defense. Shortly afterwards, an update. Don't surrender. Then thirdly, don't endanger life. How was any self-respecting soldier supposed to follow these mealy-mouthed, muddle-minded orders? At 10:00 hours 30 on the 3rd of April, the Bahia Paraiso radioed Grieg Viken with this message. Following our successful operation in the Malvinas, your ex-governor has unconditionally surrendered the Falklands and its dependencies. We suggest you gather in a group on the beach, and we will send a party of Marines ashore to accept your surrender. The defenders asked for 2 hours to think about it, trying to buy time. The Argentinian response was immediate. You have 5 minutes. When their time was up, two Alouette gunships came clattering overhead and a small warship, the corvette Corrico, sailed towards the harbour. Mills was heading towards the jetty to tell the first officer ashore that South Georgia was going to be defended, but he never got the chance. One of the Alouettes had already landed, disgorging a section of troops. The Argentinians opened fire and the British returned fire, aiming at the large Puma helicopter that had also appeared and was hovering over the water about 150 yards from their position. They hit it with hundreds of rounds in total, firing everything they had, machine guns, automatic rifles, and a rocket which missed by a hair's breadth. The Puma spluttered smoke and flew away, the 20 Argentinian troops aboard saved by remarkable flying, although it did crash land shortly afterwards. The Royal Marines then turned their attention to the corvette, holding their fire until it sailed right into the harbour. Then they hit it with everything they had. One rocket hit her side, a second pulverised the Exocet launcher on her deck, a third hit her gun turret, and she took over 1,200 rounds of small arms and machine gun fire before the Grieco turned and beat a hasty retreat back to sea. But the Royal Marines were in a suicidal position. 50 more Argentinian troops hit the beach as the Alouettes flew back and forth from the Bahia Paraiso, and the Grieco turned and, out of small arms range, began raining 100mm shells down on the British. After an hour of fighting, Mills surrendered. They were taken into custody, and within a few days would join their comrades on their way home to Britain. When Astiz returned to Leith Bay that night, he told the Frenchman that four of his men had died and a fifth had been wounded. Astiz was also proving why he was so hated by his own countrymen. Remember, he was a butcher, a torturer, a spy for his junta. And now the Frenchman began to pick up ominous signs that his friendly nature was merely a cover. He appeared to be in a very bad mood, and worrying that their time of being friends with this man had run out, they asked for permission to leave the islands. Astiz readily agreed, and then insisted inscribing this in their log. We were lucky to meet each other, although we were all in the wrong place at the wrong time. He signed it, Alfredo Astiz at the end of the world. And right now, we must end this episode. Next week, we'll join both the task force steaming towards the Falklands and the Argentinians as they begin entrenching around Port Stanley and beyond. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you can. It helps increase the visibility. Or if you'd like to contact me, you can email me through the website abwarpodcast.com or direct message me on Twitter. My handle is @DesLatham. Until next, goodbye.